Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Insurrection Leader Lady P, no relation to Master P. And always thinking of the children is co-producer Martin Kessler.
I'm handing out free baguettes.
Nice. Also with us today is dirty, stinking, pacifist hippie, and FlixWise regular, Miss Kristen Sales.
Wow. I've never been called that before.
Yeah. You're welcome. On today's show, we have mayhem and chaos in the streets. This episode, we're covering the 48th film on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Gillo Pontecorvo's 1966 feature, The Battle of Algiers. Then we're going to take a cue from Algiers' unflinching depiction of horrific bloodshed to talk about violence in the movies, specifically how we respond to different kinds of violence, and we'll talk about some instances where we felt violence was used effectively. Then we'll offset all the horrific imagery with our final notes of positivity. All right, guys, things could get ugly. You prepared?
Yep.
Sure.
Sure?
I'll try.
Okay.
To protect myself.
Thanks, Kristen. First up, we have Italian filmmaker Gillo Pontecorvo's 1966 feature, The Battle of Algiers. Summing up this film is no easy task, largely because the film can be viewed through several lenses. Is Battle of Algiers the story of a young grifter named Ali LaPont, who rises through the ranks of a small paramilitary organization which seeks to liberate Algeria from French colonialist intruders? Or is it the story of Colonel Mathieu, played by Jean-Luc Godard? But actually, Jean Martin. He totally looks like Jean-Luc Godard, right?
A tall Godard. Like, yeah. Godard and a half.
I'm sorry. Maybe it's just any guy who wears sunglasses inside looks like Jean-Luc Godard to me. Colonel Mathieu is a pragmatic former resistance leader turned paratrooper commander who's willing to go to any lengths to protect French citizens from the encroaching threat of guerrilla warfare. The film offers no easy answers as to the greater moral implications of killing in the name of justice or principle, though it certainly makes its sympathies known. What it does offer is an unsparing look into the costs and the horrors of imperialism and terrorism. In the end, the French victory proves pyrrhic and short-lived. Battle of Algiers is often cited as the ne plus ultra of cinema verite style of filmmaking, with its grainy film stock and cameras that rattle with every explosion, giving it the appearance of a documentary or even a newsreel. The effect is striking. The viewer feels as though they were dropped into the middle of a battlefield right along with the French paratroopers. The film has won both audience and critical approval, and it's now in the number 48 spot on the Sight and Sound Greatest of All Time list. Pontecorvo's battle for critical plaudits was fought and won handily some years ago, but will he win the war for this panel's affection? Let's find out. All right, guys. Do you like Battle of Algiers? Kristen, let's start with you.
Yeah, it's a great movie.
Okay.
Although I don't know if affection is a way that I would describe anyone's reaction towards this movie. It's too prickly. How can you love a movie?
People love this movie, I think.
Well,
right?
I think it depends on what you use it for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're like a leftist freedom fighter who's very politically minded and you come to this film through a political lens of wanting to be agitated or looking to be agitated for a cause, then I think affection might be a result, because you will have found something that you could use in whatever cause you want to forward. But if you're just a movie person and you're just sort of watching it going through one of these best of lists, or if it comes across your slate of films in film school or for a recommendation of just being a landmark in international cinema, then I don't know what your reactions would be, if it would be love. I would be hard pressed to find a cinephile who loves this just because the filmmaking is extraordinary.
Really?
Well, yeah, because I don't think it engenders that kind of strong, like, reaction. Some films you see and you fall in love with them because they are lovable to a certain extent, mm-hmm. and I don't think that this film is one of them.
Okay.
Because it's too, I mean, it keeps you at a distance aesthetically and for its purposes, because it is a political film. Mm-hmm. So I think unless you're coming at it from a mindset of a person who wants to be politically motivated and politically agitated, I don't know if you would describe this as like, oh yeah, I saw a film and I love it. It's my favorite film.
Yeah.
That to me doesn't make sense.
Okay, so that's interesting. Battle of Algiers is apparently unlovable. Martin. Do you agree?
Maybe I'm that cinephile that you're describing, because
yeah.
I like it, I admire it, but I'm sort of not sure how much I can trust the film. That was sort of my reaction to it.
That's totally fair. It's a piece of agitprop. I don't know that it aspires to be anything more.
Well, I think it aspires to be relatively even-handed.
Really?
Yeah, I think it does, because that's its aspiration. I think it accomplishes that to a certain extent, but there's so much history that has passed by since this film was made. I really don't know how anyone could view it with neutrality.
Yeah, I don't think it aspires to be even-handed. I don't think it wants to be a complete piece of just pure... I don't think it wants to be pure propaganda, but I think it makes its affections or its sympathies known.
I think so, but it does aspire to give both sides their moments of humanity and highlight like what both the French and the Algerian resistance fighters are sort of going through.
Mm-hmm. It does, but it's very selective in what it does choose to show you. And I think part of that actually makes me a little bit wary of the film, because you realize that it gives you this sort of illusion of objectivity, this documentary-like qualities, saying, oh, we're showing both sides. But it's all sort of in service of making, I think, the filmmaker's point.
Mm, yeah.
Well, I think anyone mistaking this for documentary, that's the viewer's own mistake.
Mm, yeah.
So I think if you're an unsophisticated viewer and you take this at its on its surface level of being more realist than another film that uses more traditional narrative framework, that's on you, because, you know, you haven't been around very long. So I think, you know, it's pretty obvious that this is, you know, using documentary-like tactics to make a fictionalized version of a version of something that happened. And there are many pieces to it. So I think, you know, people, buyer beware. I mean, people are going to bring their naivete and their idealism into this movie or their cynicism into this movie. And it's up to you to determine to what extent it works on you.
Mm-hmm. Can we just talk specifically about the conflict? We're talking about the French-Algerian war.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about, you know, what I mentioned, the film makes its sympathies plain. I think that Pontecorvo is very blatantly siding with the Algerians against the French. And what he's doing is using shaky cam and grainy film stock to kind of give you the illusion that this is somehow objective, right? I mean, I think that's kind of... Well, you're making a face, Kristen. Explain.
Well, I think it's using the aesthetic of, like, reportage or newsreel or whatever, because it is being shot in the locations where the conflict took place 5 or 7 years after the fact. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe 10 years after the fact. But I don't think it's... I don't think it's necessarily duplicitous and trying to trick people into thinking that it's real. And actually, in the U.S., it was advertised specifically, and it said there's no newsreel footage in this. But I think that's because Americans would not believe that. I don't think necessarily French or European audiences would have that kind of naivete to think that it was real.
Hmm, maybe.
I think, yeah.
Yeah.
And also because in America, it was released the sort of right when Vietnam was heating up, and people were sort of being shell-shocked with this kind of imagery. So it was important for the Americans to know that, like, this wasn't news. It just looks like news.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but why take that tactic over, say, something like, what's another example of a horrific war movie?
The film that it brought to mind was the later film, Army of Shadows, Jean-Pierre Melville's. But I think Melville's film has afforded a more traditional narrative structure and a visual structure, because it's a subject that European and American and Western audiences are more familiar with, because its subject is French resistance fighters during World War II, and that's a story that people in the West are more familiar with. And because this film takes the point of view of the Algerians, and it's about their fight, and they are the main characters, the Western people are not the main characters, that there had to be, or Pontecorvo thought that there had to be an aesthetic shift to be able to communicate that to the people who are primarily seeing this, which are Western audiences. Mm-hmm. So there is an element of exoticism, I think, in the treatment of that, which is how can we convey these images, which are relatively and these stories, which are relatively unfamiliar to Western audiences, except apart from like newsreel footage, because, to be honest, like, really the only times you see the stories of quote-unquote third world peoples in that time, and also today, arguably, is on the news. So you don't really get fictionalized narrative stories of these kind of people unless the main character in the movie is, like, a Western character, like, among the third world peoples.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
No, it's that's true. And I think, like, I mean, where I'm from, like, my father, you know, when he was a kid, got woken up in the morning because there were Russian tanks in the streets. And I think most Americans don't have that kind of experience of having a foreign invader and being able mm-hmm. to relate to it. And I think that's why you see in most American films, the terrorists or freedom fighters are usually, like, generic bad guys, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because unless there's, like, an American reporter in a war zone, like, mm-hmm. we don't really get those kinds of stories. Like, mm-hmm. that's really the way that Hollywood or Western cinema in general, like, narrativizes those kinds of stories. Is like,
right.
Oh, there must be an American reporter somewhere here in the Middle East, and let's tell their story. And then, like, the people who are actually fighting or the people that are native to that country are sort of the supporting characters.
And right. even in action films, like, there's, you know, Rambo teaming up with Taliban and things like that. It's almost mm-hmm. always through that outsider.
Mm-hmm. But Pontecorvo was influenced by Rossellini films. So while, like, Algeria is sort of an exotic location, it's a battle we're unfamiliar with, he's taking style traits from, like, Paisan, or I think he cited Rome Open City, I think. So it's not, well, you're right. Well, it is something that's kind of unfamiliar to us. It wasn't totally new.
No, but I mean, like, using, like, Italian neorealism to humanize the subjects of people who are, of non-Western subjects, is in itself a relatively radical point of view. So mm. just, like, giving the Algerian people, who are not actors like they would have been in the Italian mm-hmm. Neorealist style, to give them the same kind of credence and say, like, oh, we're going to use these techniques for these people as well, is in itself, like, sort of a political statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the only proper actor in the movie is the French general or whatever, yeah. the army
Lieutenant
guy.
Colonel, yeah.
Right, is in itself, like, kind of a political joke. Like, do you know what I mean? It's you know, and he's, like, a very, like, dry, very French character who has sort of a, like, a very, very low-key, sardonic view of things.
Yeah.
And he's making all of these sort of statements that you view with retrospect, with some, like, rueful retrospect, where, you mm-hmm. know, it's not going to last very long.
I mean, how do you feel that there are so many, like, there's not really too much focus on specific, like, there are specific characters that you see recurring, like you mentioned, but you get the sort of impression that you're watching a group.
Exactly, yeah. That was what really struck me, is that, I mean, there are characters there are names of people involved, but the only real person, the only character that really struck me was the colonel.
Mm. Right, because he's the individual.
Yeah.
So, like, the French side or whatever is more Western, so there has to be a strong central individual, because that's how storytelling works. And then in the Algerian side, it's, like, there are individuals who I would say, well, like, the main characters are, like, the main resistance fighters, but it's more or less how that community works as a group.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in the sort of in the first sequences of the, I guess you could say, the terrorist acts, the fact that all of them are sort of anonymous, mm-hmm. and it's just sort of regular individuals going about their daily business in the Casbah, and they like sort of pick up a gun in an anonymous location. They, you know, assassinate a police officer, and then they drop the gun where they found it, and then they leave. So it's like this kind of like shifting, sort of untenable, but sort of like very sequential and like organized, like organism of just people that are sort of like working together, but also not like connecting. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of just like this like free floating idea of like, this is what we're going to do as Algerians, mm-hmm. but we're not going to use sort of like Western conceptions of like military organizations, because if we did that, then they could infiltrate us. And that's eventually what the French do, mm-hmm. is that they figure out how these people are connected, and then they break down the sort of like triangles of association that the Algerians are having, and and then they break them down one by one. It's like they start getting the names of the people and mm-hmm. start breaking it down.
Right, exactly, yeah. But how does Pontecorvo get us to side with the Algerians, like, specifically? Are we just naturally inclined as Americans to root for the underdog? I don't think that's it.
I mean, I think it's our natural inclination as filmgoers to side with whatever is going to make for the more interesting dramatic arc. Mm-hmm. And I think underdog stories are always more dramatic. So obviously the film is structured so that we are rooting for the people who have the most to gain and the most to lose, because it's more dramatically interesting.
Mm-hmm. I think the film does make a point to show you, you know, mothers crying when their children have been arrested, and it even the soundtrack, like the soundtrack's really powerful, and the Morricone score, sort of, you know, if you listen carefully, it does tell you when to feel, and it quiets down in other scenes, and you know, there's a bunch of dead Algerians, and the music makes you want to cry, or the mm-hmm. torturing, it's very hard to watch, I think partly just because of the soundtrack. It's telling you how wrong this is. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's also very militaristic. Like, I'm thinking of the Battle of Algiers theme, which is justly famous and has been used in other movies. It's used for both sides. It's used both for the French and also, like, when the French are on the move, but also when the Algerians are on the move to do their quote-unquote terrorist acts. So it kind of gets you pumped up for both. Mm-hmm. It gets you pumped up for the violence, you know, full stop.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of funny that that piece of music specifically, I think a film it was used in was the Quentin Tarantino film Inglourious Bastards, right? Which is all about the weaponization of film and using film as a tool for the proliferation of ideology, right? And mm-hmm. I mean, Tarantino, like, of course, he steals stuff, but he sort of does it with the intent that you kind of follow through and understand the baggage that those elements that he borrows comes with. But I think that made me think a little bit about how it was used in the film and what the film's overall purpose was, Battle of mm-hmm. Viewers. It's fighting a war of ideology, right? Just like the Algerians are.
The film itself is fighting a war of ideology?
I think so. Like, it's trying to persuade you, and it's all about, you know, ultimately at the end, even though the French do everything tactically correct, they lose because they lose the war of ideology. And I think the film is sort of both celebrating that and also trying to show that to viewers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the ultimate lesson, I think, of this movie. And the one that remains 50 years after the fact is that a filmic document can become a propaganda document, but it can also become, it can be proliferated into many different uses. So I think this film retains a relevancy that maybe many other films about conflicts or about wars or about resistance fighters does not, because it is so rousing. Mm-hmm. It's so and I think the score is a big part of that. And I think that using it in Inglourious Basterds is a stroke of genius. I mean, I have that album actually on vinyl, and so when I heard it again, after listening to the Inglourious Basterds album so many times, I was like, ah, yes. This is, I forgot, it's like to see it back in its original context is very like, because I think when you watch the Tarantino film, it gets you pumped up exactly for violence without thinking of the consequence of that violence. And not to get off track too much, because I think Inglourious Basterds is a very, very complicated film, more so than people really give it credit for.
I agree, yeah.
But when you watch the sequences in which the Battle of Algiers score is used, it's for the Hugo Stiglitz character, who is sort of just like the big guy that likes murdering Nazis. And so it kind of seems like the baseline most moral homicide of all, because it's the Nazi killing Nazis, but within that is a lot of very complicated allegiances and a lot of things where you're like, wait a minute, is this right? And so I think it is sort of a very like morally it's taking a cue from a film which is very morally complex and putting it into a film that many people do not think is morally complex, but actually is. Yeah. So it's like, it's a very, very like skillful use of recontextualizing that music cue.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Battle of Algiers, it's an uncomfortable truth that we're faced with in the film, that idea that violence can be justifiable and that...
or even enjoyable.
Terrorism is effective. You know, this film says, well, like, maybe even if you set aside the moral, is it right or wrong, it says it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it satisfies certain desires. Mm-hmm. So, like, certain things are accomplished through terrorism. I think the more, I'm forgetting his name in the film, but sort of the more intellectual leader, that's not Jafar, he has, in his bit of dialogue, he says that, like, terrorism doesn't win wars, it's just a means to an end, and then ultimately the people have to take it up. They have to, you know, take up their own responsibility for their own culture and how they're going to live or whatever. And that's precisely what happens in the movie, mm-hmm. is that terrorism, they're sort of terrorist acts, and I say terrorism in quotes because, you know, terrorism as defined by their
it's the one person's their colonizers. Terrorist is another's freedom fighter, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, it works up to a point. It works to help. I guess you could say radicalize the other Algerians into sort of organizing. And then after their quote-unquote defeat in 1957, and then years later, it resurges. And then that sort of more cultural upheaval that is not as characterized by this like violent upheaval actually does lead to their eventual independence. Mm-hmm. So in a way, the film actually is sort of saying, like, this worked.
yeah,
right. which is a very dangerous thing, and to Western audiences, and even to, and I think it was dangerous when it was released in America, because certain marginalized groups in America watched this film and used it sort of as a training manual,
right.
Or they used it as a recruiting tool,
right.
And that still happens. I mean, people still watch this movie to get pumped up about the possibility of whatever revolution they're into succeeding, because it did succeed.
Yeah. Oh, it's sort of funny. Like, usually when we talk about like films influencing people to violence, it's like you're talking about the Arnold Schwarzenegger right. film, or it's not usually something or that like, we consider Batman, like you know, artful film that's on the sight and sound list, right?
Yeah.
Right, because I think there's a fundamental difference between political violence or violence that's politically motivated and sort of, I guess you could say, aesthetic violence or violence that is for the sake of visual pleasure.
Though I think, like, there is a certain element of, like, visual pleasure in Battle of Algiers, like, when they're, the women are dressing up to look a little bit more French, to cross checkpoints and deliver bombs. And there's guys with sunglasses. Like, it's kind of cool. It's sexy. It's I don't know. Maybe I mean, it was just me thinking that.
And that's the funny thing too, is that like left wing violence is always kind of sexy in movies. Like, I'm thinking of like when you get into the 70s and you get into like the Bader-Meinhof complex and all these like artsy European things, or like when Godard got radicalized and all of his sort of like, it's just so very sexy, and it's just all of these like very, and it's funny too because it's like all these Algerian revolutionaries, or most of them, are like very young, kind of good looking, and you're like, oh dang, like these people are like really into it, they're like willing to die for their country, whereas like all of these French people are like old and stodgy and
that police,
you know,
officer
old soldiers and everything. They don't seem to be in it for any good reason. They're just there because it's like, that's their job,
except for the colonel.
Well, but no, I think it's his job too.
Yeah, but I think he's there. He knows why he's there. Like, he's the coolest character in the movie, I think.
Oh, really? You think
so? Yeah, I think so. I appreciate his directness.
Yeah, he just seems like way too
not cool.
Aloof.
Yeah, not cool. Well, because that's never cool.
No, I just mean like too aloof for like for the job that he has to be doing. Mm-hmm. Like it never seems of any particular consequence to him whether they win or lose, which is not exactly a quality that I would look for in my military leaders.
Yeah.
But do you feel like on some level that betrays the complexity of the real life? Because, you know, when it's showing the Algerians, the violence feels very cinematic and justified and cool, and then you have French torturing people, and that's what it shows you, the inherent ugliness of violence. Like it's selective in how it presents it. So like on first glance you could say, oh well, it shows you both sides of violence, but it's in choosing where it does and who it associates it with, it's making a politicized point. I mean,
absolutely.
That's, of course it is. But,
yeah, but. No, I think you're right. Is that, because you mentioned at the beginning, Martin, that you're a little bit skeptical about this film, and I don't know if we ever got pinpointed exactly why that is. Is that basically the reason?
I guess so. It's like too persuasive to trust.
Okay, yeah.
You know, I think like any film that's this stylized and this sort of makes it too easy, because I think like, as complex as the film is, it does sort of ultimately put things in a fairly black and white perspective. You know, there's enough gray that I feel like it's not a completely tactless film, of course, but I sort of think, especially with the hindsight of terrorism, decolonization, the civil war in Algeria, like it's hard not to see that looking at the film and feel
that's
like
true.
Maybe it's the conclusion is overly simplistic.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. Yeah, I had the same reaction. Like when I first saw it, it was a total revelation, and now rewatching it with through this 2016 lens with the Arab Spring and the, you know, everything that's happening in Syria.
Well, a few months
it's
ago,
very
they're
hard
shooting
to...
in Paris. Like,
yeah,
you know, that's
yeah,
it's impossible not to think of that watching this
exactly,
film.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's no longer. I can no longer cheer on these acts of violence perpetrated on French citizens. Like it's harder to
and
watch
it's,
now.
It's not to say that the French were justified
yeah,
in their
were
actions
absolutely
in Algeria.
Not.
It's
absolutely
just saying
not.
It's more complicated than
right. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think that's just a reflection of seeing this again when you're at a later stage of life. Because I saw it when I was in college, and this was like the height of the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. So obviously when I watched it, I was like, this is like what I'm seeing on the news every single day, which is, I imagine, how people reacted to it in 1966 and 67, because this was what they were seeing on the news every day, just like in Vietnam. Or, I mean, if they were American viewers, they were seeing it in Vietnam, but they were also seeing it in violent unrest here in American cities with the civil rights movement and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's one of those films that's of its time, but it also brings sharply into focus the fact that not much has changed, like politically or socially, in 50 years, because we're kind of in the same kind of fighting.
Mm-hmm. You hear that, America?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is our fault, by the way. Yeah. Just FYI.
Don't pit this on me.
No, it's not Martin's fault at all. Completely innocent.
Anyway. All right. Well, that's a good place. I think we should... that seems like a good place to leave this topic. I know we didn't really get into any of the cool scenes, but I think we've covered a lot already. So
it's hard to watch the film and not have opinions and thoughts about things that are sort of not in the film but outside of it, because that's the kind of film it is. It's
exactly yeah, it's very true.
Right, it's a good, this is why people, they constantly show this film in colleges, because it's a film that gets you talking about stuff that is the film but also outside of the film.
Exactly. Yep. That being said, I know there were reservations on all of our counts, but 48 on the Sight and Sound critics poll. What do you think?
I think it's, if anything, it's probably low. I mean, we've just revealed the fact that this film probably has more relevance to our day-to-day lives than many, many, many other of the films that are on the list. And it's inarguably a well-made film in terms of technique and in terms of, you know, incorporating certain elements of film history and sort of innovating in other elements. So I don't know why it wouldn't. I think it more than justifies 48.
Okay. I like it. Martin, what do you think?
I mean, I was pretty hard on the film, but I think for the reasons that you mentioned, like, I'm glad the film can allow us to have this conversation, because mm-hmm. a lot of films wouldn't. I'm fine with it where it is.
48? All right, 48.
Yeah.
I can deal with 48, yeah.
Unlike many other films that are closed universes, this is an open universe, mm-hmm. which sort of puts it in a different realm of filmmaking. Then, not that one of those is better than the other, but I think it's categorically very dissimilar from many of the other films we're talking about.
It's true. It was
that sort of it exists on their own
because it is so different than a lot of the recent films that we've discussed. I know it's a very serious subject matter. It's a very difficult subject matter, but I enjoyed watching it. It is an easy watch in many ways. A lot of the films on this list are slower paced. This is not.
Mm.
This is this will keep you on the edge of your seat. And Martin, I know before we started talking, you mentioned that your dad really likes this movie.
Yeah, of course he does.
Yeah, this is a total dad movie.
It's a dad movie, and like,
yeah,
it's. Like, I think a lot of, like, the dad movies that came out in the 70s and 80s that I think he likes are sort of inspired by this in some way.
Okay.
You know, I think of films like Day of the Jackal.
Yeah, Jean Martin probably is how you say that. He's in Day of the Jackal.
That's right.
So.
So yeah.
Making dad films. All right, well, that seems like it's good. Let's leave it at that, and listeners can come tell us what they think of Battle of Algiers. As we just discussed, the Battle of Algiers is unrelentingly violent. So for our second topic, we thought we'd use the Battle of Algiers as a jumping-off point to discuss the larger implications of depicting these acts of brutality. Plus, we'll cite some instances where we feel violence was used effectively. So, I feel like every time a Quentin Tarantino movie comes out, we get about a million think pieces about violence in cinema. Those are always opportunities to discuss whether or not films are too violent. But what do you think about, just generally, about the discourse surrounding the topic? Does it make you roll your eyes? Are you kind of ready to have the debate? Or is it something that just doesn't interest you at all? I don't know. Martin, how about you?
Well, I feel like the two points you always hear come up are either violence in film perpetuates violence, or seeing violence in film works as a sort of cathartic experience and makes you less likely to commit mm-hmm. violence. And I don't really agree with either thing.
Yeah.
I think like maybe it's not the amount of violence so much as the thought behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe senseless violence is what bothers me less than extreme violence that has maybe some point or some consideration behind it. So.
Yeah.
That's sort of where I stand.
Yeah. Kristen, how about you?
I find the whole discourse to be so boring and annoying and not even really relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Just specious in general, just this whole thing of, oh, won't somebody think of the children, or we're turning, you know, a blind eye to our youth, and oh, these, it used to be movies, and then, you know, it was cartoons, and or it was comic books, or it was video games, or blah blah blah. Every new media, you know, has 1 million moms up in arms or whatever kind of nonsense. It's just nonsense, I think.
Uh-huh.
It's just one of those things where this is an easy crutch to fall back on that ignores actual social issues that require actual social action and engagement and, God forbid, laws. Or, you know, political, you know, whatever. It's just one of those, like, that old jaded, you know, liberal thing where they're just, you know, they're coming for our art, but they're not looking at themselves. They're not looking at what poverty does. They're mm-hmm. not looking at any number of other factors. And it's not so much that violence in media and movies doesn't exist, because obviously it does. But at a certain base level, violent depictions in media make people violent. It's just not tenable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just nonsense.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's ever been anything proven to suggest otherwise. Violent video games, violent music, violent movies do not make people violent. In fact, while you're sitting and watching a movie, you are much less likely to be violent because it's sort of a passive activity.
The hot summer nights make people more violent than a Tarantino movie marathon, I can guarantee you. Because if you're watching a Tarantino movie marathon, you're in an air-conditioned theater. So when it gets very hot, I recommend you go to a theater and watch a movie, and then you'd be less likely to riot or break into a car or hit somebody or any number of violent acts that are triggered by the weather every year. So
that being said, I do think that the way that we show violence, there are larger societal repercussions, because I sort of balk at the suggestion that the way we represent things doesn't matter. Period.
Well, from a filmmaker perspective, I think you're sort of caught between a weird place where you're like, oh, I want to make movies that affect people. And then you talk about, oh, violence in film doesn't affect people. So
yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, of course it does. Of course, if you make gun violence seem cool, it's going to seem cool. I'm trying to think of a violent scene. So Kill Bill, the violence in Kill Bill. I don't think anyone was too up in arms about the depiction of violence. It was very graphic.
I mean, I think people were just up in arms over the fact that it was so over the top and it became, it was expressionistic, which it was very funny to me that people get upset about expressionistic violence as opposed to realistic violence. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other topic. I think the thing with Kill Bill that happened, and I'm trying to remember what the discourse that happened when it came out, was that it was so that the excessive amount of blood was equated to excessive amounts of violence. But I think that's sort of a false equivalency, that bloody equals violent. Mm. Because to me, violence, the way that you would define violence in a movie, is violence is something that causes a personal upheaval and is disturbing and grotesque to you, because that's what violence is in real life. So if something violent happens to you, it's an upheaval and it's a disturbance. So if you're watching a quote unquote violent depiction in a movie and it doesn't disturb you, is it really violence? Mm,
That's
my definition.
Well, I mean, you could make the argument that that's the sort of violence that makes it more normalized. You know, when you're watching a slapstick comedy or a Jackie Chan comedy and there's punching and nobody seems to get hurt, is that actually maybe, somebody could make the argument that that normalizes it and makes it feel like you can be violent without having any real repercussions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I read some quote, David Lynch said something to that effect, like it's horrific when you see a violent scene and no one is hurt.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, what always disturbs me are the old Westerns where people get shot and there's no blood and they just kind of go and fall over. And that's it. The dying is so sanitized. And it's almost gone back to that, where films are cut down a lot to get this PG-13 rating. Well, you'll have the hero come in and shoot a million people and there's no blood. There's no pain. There's no nothing that makes you feel uncomfortable with the violence. So I like it when you have a film like Terry Gilliam's Brazil, where there's a moment when they blow up a factory and blow up all these bad guys and they go, ha ha. And then he cuts back to one of the faceless henchmen just on fire and in pain, because he thought it was important to remind people that people get hurt.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to think of another instance in a recent blockbuster where basically nameless faceless background player was humanized in that way. Because, there's so much bloodshed in these movies, and
well, it's not even bloodshed, because if you're killing real people in a movie to get a PG-13 rating, actually, you can't show blood. You can only show the blood of non you can only show, like, brutal deaths of non-humans. You get, like, an unlimited amount of non-humans.
Right. You'll have, like, Wesley Snipes come in and he chops up vampires, and instead of blood coming out, they just turn into ashes. Or
yeah, but yeah. I was also thinking of just, like, all those Marvel movies. That's why they're always fighting aliens, or any other fake made-up race, is because there's an unlimited amount of those CG aliens that you can kill in any manner of ways, but they're non-humans, so that the way that the ratings board has it, you can get rid of them in any sort of, you can dispatch them in any sort of way that you want to. And that's why you have so many sci-fi and fantasy movies right now, arguably, is because that's sort of the sanctioned violence that you can have under the ratings board. Mm-hmm. So whereas in the 80s and early 90s, you get a lot of really violent action movies with the action heroes of the time. Those were like rated R a lot of the times, and they were killing dudes. Mm-hmm. They weren't killing, mm-hmm. you know, whatever,
yeah.
spacemen from Thorland or yeah. whatever. I don't know what the Marvel people are fighting, but yeah, it's a lot different.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think it's a reminder that we should all watch Starship Troopers, because aliens, it turns out, do have feelings, and they don't appreciate being colonized any more than Algerians. So,
Paul Verhoeven, so many of his films do deal with violence and sometimes go into very surprising or uncomfortable territory, and I'm always fascinated by the way he plays with tone. Like, RoboCop's a film I've loved since I was very young, and in the first act, you have two scenes that are very near to each other, where in one, there's the guy in the board meeting who's shot a million times, and it's shocking and hilarious, and then, you know, a few minutes later, you have the cop, Alex Murphy, shot a million times, and it's shocking and heartbreaking, and it's just, essentially the same thing happening, but the way he plays with the tone, the way he plays with how you've already gotten to know one of these characters, it has such a different effect on you, which is important for how you experience that story and go along with it, and all of that. But I always find it very interesting how you can have very similar acts of violence, even in the same film, and just have completely wildly different emotional reactions.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that's a great example of something like that I want to make clear. Just because you object to certain kinds of violence doesn't mean that violence can't be used in a humorous way. Like, it just, like, some forethought would be nice.
Obviously context is paramount.
Yeah.
Which is a truism in any realm of filmmaking, is that you can't just take scenes out of their context and expect to fully understand them or appreciate them in the way that the filmmaker meant them. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, some thought would be nice. I mean, that's just kind of a bottom line hope that we all hope that the people making our media, you know, put some modicum of thought into what they're presenting.
Right. Yeah.
That doesn't always happen, but sometimes, you know.
Yeah. But I mean, how do you feel about, I guess you've kind of made your feelings pretty clear, but like in our modern blockbuster age, it is kind of like kids bashing together their toys, kind of like the stakes feel so low, even though there is this pretty high death toll.
They just feel totally alienating. Like, you know, which is not to say that all superhero movies are bad. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that when you sort of take out the realm of consequence and all of the casualties most of the casualties are off screen. A lot of them are faceless and it's just sort of like very impersonal carnage. It's like, what's the point? Like, there are no stakes with the characters that the film has taken the time to set up. Mm-hmm. There's no stakes to whatever larger point you're trying to make about the world we live in or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, where's the relevancy?
I think like maybe the only Marvel film I actually like really like is Punisher Warzone, which I think is maybe their only R-rated one.
Yeah,
and it was like a flop at the time.
Yeah, cause this one, it was before like they were doing the Marvel Universe, so it's kind of outside of that.
I mean, it's not my fault. I saw it twice in theaters, but it was like so violent and like it does go into that like Grand Guignol satiric kind of territory, and it's. You know, feels completely on the other side of these sanitized superhero films. I like that one.
Mm. Yeah, I think I need to be to advocate on behalf of cartoonish violence and bloodless violence. I enjoyed the Avengers movie. It felt novel at the time, but at the same time, I am glad that we can have this discussion about it felt like like an old timey Western. To be honest, there's something very old fashioned about it.
And those old timey Westerns, that's the reason why America is such a pacifist country, right?
That's it. Yes.
No.
I don't need the blood for there to be stakes. Like, there's no blood splatter in The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance. In fact, it's all about violence, right? It's a it's a violent film. Somebody dies, and yet you feel the impact, but the impact of the violence, of the limited violence, is there.
Yeah, well, I often think that the most violent films I've ever seen are films where there is no bloodshed and no physical violence. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if this fits the topic, but usually the films that disturb or unsettle me the most, that have the most what I would define as violence in them, are like emotional upheaval or just people being very, very cruel to one another. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, I think violence without cruelty is very dangerous if you're trying to make a realistic movie or a realistic depiction of what violence is. And not all movies have to be realistic, but I think violence without cruelty or without degradation or without some aspect of humiliation, without some aspect of the emotional things that sort of surround people being doing harm to one another, sort of takes out a lot of the power of those actions.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Martin Scorsese called The Age of Innocence his most violent film.
That is in my notes here. Nice. Age of Innocence. Yeah, I agree with him that it is his most violent movie. That movie...
It's the emotional violence.
Yeah.
That movie fucks me up every time. It is so wrenching. Mm-hmm. And the ways that people manipulate each other and the ways that people are trapped by, you know... Not by, like, chains, but by, you know, societal chains. Mm-hmm. and just the sort of intractability of that kind of societal violence is devastating. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's very, very hard to convey that skillfully. Not that it's not hard to make a physically violent movie that also requires a set of skills, but I think if you're talking about violence in cinema, you have to talk about different types of violence. Mm-hmm. In Age of Innocence is, yeah, it's yeah. The absolute carnage, that mm-hmm. movie.
Brutal.
It's brutal.
Okay, well, maybe let's talk about, I know we're heading into more emotional violence, mm-hmm. but let's talk about some notable instances where violence was used effectively, whether it be just like something that we enjoyed just for the formal aspects, like that was a gorgeously composed scene, or something where the violence had a real emotional impact, or, you know, take your pick. Mm. Martin, do you have a suggestion?
I have a couple.
Okay.
One film where I really like the use of violence is Takashi Kitano's The Toichi remake, where, like, I think partly because he has a comedic background and he's also made all these violent gangster movies, the blood splatter in his film, it's almost between, like, a haiku and the punchline to a joke. It's sort of... The timing of it, the shock, but also the beauty of it. I always am fascinated by the violence in his films.
I've never heard of it.
It's a little bit in the tradition of, like, those samurai movies, like Sanjuro, where the person gets cut and it's like this geyser of blood that comes out. It's also a little bit expressionistic, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another one is Coffee with Pam Grier.
Yes.
There's a scene I saw like way too young where she ties little razor blades into her hair and then gets mm-hmm. into a fight, mm-hmm. and the other woman goes to pull her hair and just gets her hand slashed, and I'm almost scared to go back and rewatch it because, like, in my mind I think it's, like, probably become more horrific and brutal than it might actually be, but I have this, like, I think mostly just the shock of seeing that. Mm-hmm. You sort of get this setup where you're not quite sure what's happening, and then the payoff, it's very, very shocking, and in my mind, that, like, slashed up head, it's really gruesome. a pair of films that I sort of associate in a kind of roundabout way are Badlands and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where they're these poetic kind of psychopath films from Texas filmmakers, and they have such different takes on the violence that I find it really interesting. Like Badlands, that's going to be like, I think, one of the best depictions of a psychopath in a film, because he seems so, I don't want to say normal, but like there's no point where like he's acting scary. It's like what makes that character really scary to me is just he's like somebody who's watched those westerns where he sort of feels like there are no repercussions to him killing. He sort of shoots people, and it's I think Martin Sheen said that Terrence Malick's direction to him was that the gun would be like a magic wand. You just like point it and people will stop. And then Texas Chainsaw Massacre, it goes kind of in the other direction, where it's this like horrific onslaught. And I actually thought it was interesting, the director Toby Hooper said that he wanted to edit it as if it was going to get a PG rating, always the violent scenes. Like, there's actually very little violence you see in the film if you're looking carefully, but so much of it's suggested that I think it's actually more horrific because a lot of it like creates violence in your imagination.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre is probably the best American horror film of that sort of new wave of horror films, like post Psycho or post Night of the Living Dead, that it is extremely terrifying, but mostly because it starts out and is mostly composed of psychological violence, and most of the violence is indeed off-screen.
Yeah.
I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre is actually on the Sight Hidden Sound list, right?
It is indeed.
So we'll talk about that someday.
Eventually we'll get to it. I think it's
pretty
bottom,
near the bottom.
It's very, very good. Yeah. I think in terms of people who are sort of the poets of violence, and this is a cliche, but I really do like Sam Peckinpah.
Okay.
And I think that the way that he aestheticized violence, that it was never too glossy. It never sort of left behind the sort of very, very deeply ugly origins of people being cruel to each other, which, you know, it's not pleasant to watch, but I think that that is more in line with my thinking of, if you're going to depict violent people doing violent acts, there should be a level of degradation. There should be a level of just making you feel bad about observing these certain things. So I think something like Straw Dogs or Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, or even like The Wild Bunch, probably like the climax of The Wild Bunch is justly famous for being sort of, for the time, absurdly violent. And it's still very affecting and very arousing and disturbing now, it is, even though so many people have ripped off Peckinpah's style. But I do think that he sort of like was able to capture a way of conveying violence visually that retained some of its sort of truer aspects, even while being very, very sort of beautiful to look at.
I just kind of want to throw in Hitchcock, just because you know, the shower scene in Psycho, we've been over it before, but it remains just a staggering piece of cinema. And just the impressionistic murder scene, the impressionistic death, the impressionistic violence, sort of the way it's cut to suggest stabbing rather than actually showing stabbing. I mean, that's sort of the name of the game here, is like, how do you convey a sense of violence most effectively?
Have you seen Frenzy? Hitchcock's Frenzy?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
See, because I always think of that when people bring up Psycho as being sort of exemplary of the kind of violence that Hitchcock would do. I always bring up Frenzy as the flip side of it. Because to me, Frenzy is Hitchcock entering the 70s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you have a filmmaker as formally accomplished as Hitchcock, and all of his movies in this, I guess, post The Birds are very staid, and you can tell that he's holding back and maybe even bored of his own style. And then you get Frenzy from 72, and it's like old man Hitchcock like trying to play you know, with the, you know, the new era of Hollywood filmmakers.
Well, it's bonkers. Like, that's the, like, 1970s, you already have guys like Brian De Palma around. There's all
that's
Italian,
exactly what I was going to say. It's
giallo
like
films. It's like,
It's like Hitchcock and De Palma, like, overlapping. And because of that, it brings out, and I don't know if this is like a false reading, but it brings out sort of an element of Hitchcock that I suspect was there all along, but wasn't, he didn't sort of bring that element of like very disturbing, mm-hmm. intimate violence into his films only because of the code and mm-hmm. because of the right. times in which he lives. It's kind of like old man Hitchcock, like releasing all of the perversity that he had with a newfound freedom. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely disturbing.
Yes. Well, and if you hear about his unmade film Kaleidoscope, it might've been even more of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm old-fashioned.
Yeah.
I think that the suggestion of sexualized violence is enough. I don't think it's unclear what's happening in that shower scene.
No. No, it's not clear. Yeah. It's just I think they're interesting polls of ways of conveying something.
Right,
because
exactly.
I always think that it's interesting to look at a filmmaker like Hitchcock whose career spanned such a long period of time when the standards of what you could show in good taste mm-hmm. changed so much mm-hmm. and who made a film like Psycho that really was a definitive point in pivoting standards of good taste and morality and so on and so forth in American cinema. Like, how do you trace the depictions of violence like through one filmmaker?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like to go from something from what is it called? Like Murder in 1929 or 1930 to something which, you know, is there's a very, very clever way that he shoots the murder scene in that film to something all the way into the 70s in Frenzy mm-hmm. and how you're depicting more or less the same act but very, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is really interesting.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think another scene that I'd want to bring up, and then we should probably wrap this up, the scene in Double Indemnity where what's his face? Fred McMurray strangling Barbara Stanwyck's husband. All you see is her face. Mm-hmm. That's a great, very violent scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, suggestion of violence, and we hear it. We don't actually see it.
But isn't the point of that scene more that she's getting mega turned on?
Yeah.
So it's not so much the violent act in itself, but the sexualized dimension of their sort of murderous union.
Mm-hmm.
But does that maybe just in some way reflect more attitudes towards sexuality than to violence? The fact that it's like, oh, violence is fine, but the moment you throw sex in there, it becomes, I mean, not to say that like sexualized violence should be normalized, like, no, mm-hmm. it's horrible, but I think the reactions to it, I don't know. I'm getting preachy here, but never mind.
No, I think that's absolutely
never
true.
Never mind, guys. Violence is fun.
It's all good.
It's okay. It's good.
All right. Well, I feel like that's a good place to leave it. Violence is fine. Okay.
If it worked for, if it works for Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, it works for me.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, guys. After that discussion, I think some sunshine and rainbows are in order. It's time for our final notes of positivity. Martin, what's one piece of culture that's been putting a smile on your face?
I'm a little bit late to the party, but I finally started watching Horace and Pete, the Louis C.K. web series show.
Okay, Louis C.K. You know, he went broke making those. Poor Louis C.K.
Yeah, so you should enjoy them.
Enjoy.
You have to like them now because he's broke because of you.
Is that blackmail? It's going to be the plot of his next whatever he does.
Yeah. I tried to sell finance and all I got was this T-shirt.
Yeah. it's good for him, you know?
That's right. Be a man of the people again.
That's right. All right, Kristen, how about you?
Well, I've been very busy lately, so I haven't been able to consume the adequate amount of pop culture that I have become accustomed to. But one bright spot was the second season of Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt that I was atypically late to, but I finally caught up and finished. And it was just, like, you know, delightful. I love just an absurdist comedy that I can watch one episode of, you know, after work and feel better. And that's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's just the rapidity of and variety of jokes on that show is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, how screwy can we make one line? What totally far-flung reference can we make to something that may or may not even exist? What kind of garbled nonsense can we put into the the mouths of these, like, preternaturally talented actors and just make them say the dumbest things possible? Mm-hmm. And I love it.
Yeah. No joke, that was almost my final note this week. So yeah. I've been reading these posts by Angelica Jade Bestian on RogerEbert.com. It's called The Feminine Grotesque.
Yes. And
it's those are great.
Yeah. Basically revisiting films of all of my favorite people, namely Joan Crawford, Bette Davis, Barbara Stanwyck. Yeah, again, basically all of the great heroines of the classic studio era, and kind of recontextualizing things, or basically saving... I guess recontextualizing is the word I'm going for.
I think it's just, like, valorizing their contributions in a way that says, like, these ladies were awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really always, giving them their due.
Exactly, yeah. It's always good to be reminded, like, I feel like on this show, we've all kind of done our best to remind folks that Joan Crawford and Bette Davis are two of the greatest humans who've ever lived. but it's good to hear it from other corners of the internet.
But I'm glad we didn't talk about what happened to Baby Jane and how I find it the most disturbing movie I've ever seen.
Disturbing in a good way?
No, disturbing in a disturbing way.
Okay.
I mean, it's a great movie, but...
Yeah. I mean, I think it is very disturbing, but I love it a lot.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about that on a different
topic,
episode.
Another topic. That'll be FlixWise favorites for sure. So check that out. I think it's on RogerEbert.com. It's the Boulder and Dash
blog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Great writing there.
Yeah. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise. That is. Listeners, got any examples of scenes where you felt violence was used effectively? Come let us know on our website, FlixWise.com. Or if you want to join in our fight, step one is to head over to Facebook at Facebook.com/FlixWise. Step two is to follow me on Twitter. The handle is at FlixWise. But the most important step is to go to iTunes, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. If you don't, well, let's just say I won't just talk about violence, okay?
Well,
I find threatening our audience is very effective.
Yeah. Wow.
It really gets the ratings in. Actually, I'm totally kidding, guys. Please rate us. Please. our next sight and sound entry is Jean-Luc Godard's Histoire du Cinéma. But we might have a FlixWise favorites entry before that. So stay tuned. Check us. Check social media. All right, Martin, my brother in arms.
Ready to die for the cause.
Yes. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Kristen?
Yes.
Say goodbye to the people.
Bye, people.
Yeah. All right. Until next time, shall we take to the streets?
Yeah. I have my flags made up.
Perfect.